I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. Ina is a chef, a cookbook writer, and one of the cooking stars on the Food Network. Ina officially started her culinary career when she bought a 400-square-foot store in the Hamptons on Long Island called the Barefoot Contessa. Her first cookbook sold over 2 million copies, and her Food Network show has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Ina is popular for her emphasis on no-fuss entertaining. Welcome, Ina.
It's so nice to be here, Jessica. Thanks.
I heard a story that you weren't allowed in the kitchen, yet you spend all of your waking hours in that room. What was the story behind that?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm acting out. Even at this age, I'm still acting out. My mother used to say to me, it's my job to cook, it's your job to study, get out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I spent the rest of my life trying to get into the kitchen.
And why was she so adamant about your staying out of the kitchen?
She wanted me to study hard. She was very intellectual. So to her, intellectual pursuits and culture and studying was really important. And I'm much more hands-on. I just like to roll up my sleeves and do something. And I was interested in science, and which I think really relates to cooking.
Mm. And what did your dad do?
My father was a physician. He loved to have a good time. He loved style, all those things. I think I'm very closely related to him.
Did your parents entertain a lot when you were growing up?
My parents did. My father had lots and lots of friends. I think entertaining was a little painful for my mother because she would get very nervous about it. But my father just loved having friends over.
What did you aspire to be professionally when you were growing up?
You know, I grew up in a different time than you are. I'm 59. I grew up really at the cutting edge of the women's movement. Gloria Steinem was just coming to force. And actually, I always say that my husband was the first feminist I ever met. When we were first married, I was still in college. And I remember him coming home one day, and it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was watching That Girl on TV. And he looked at me and said, you need to figure out what you're going to do with your life. And it had never occurred to me. Hmm. I thought, I'm married. That's what I do with my life.
Wow.
And so he really encouraged me to do something. And that was really the beginning of my career.
Go husband.
Yeah.
Really,
he's
really
the best.
Nice. So even though you weren't allowed in the kitchen, you still had food interwoven in your life. When you were courting your then boyfriend, now husband,
yeah.
What are examples of your cooking or baking?
Well, I don't remember when I was in high school. I have no idea what behooved me to do this, but I decided to send him brownies in a shoebox. Isn't that what we all did? And I think that pretty much won him over.
So you were in high school while he was at Dartmouth College?
Yes, he saw me when I was 15, and so I met him right soon after that when I was 16. So I was in high school, he was in college.
So after the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. you and Jeff decided to take a trip to Europe, and I'm wondering what impact that experience had on your interest in culinary endeavors.
Well, you know, it was a time, we had 4 months between when he finished the Army and he went to graduate school in Washington, and we didn't have any money. I mean, we just didn't have anything. So we decided we'd take a 4-month camping trip through Europe. And I remember we had $5 a day, literally. If we spent $10 one day, we had to go home a day early. So we bought ourselves a tent and some sleeping bags. And that was when you go to Europe on $99. So we rented a car, a little Renault 4, and we tootled around. But literally, including the campsite fee, we had $5. So I would go to the market and buy vegetables and couscous and things like that. And we had a little camping gas stove, and I would cook dinner every night.
Mm.
I just remember being so totally blown away by the markets in France. And it was just such a pleasure to go and get a baguette and a pear and a piece of brie, and that was lunch.
Mm.
And so I think that was really the beginning of my awakening of great ingredients and how you really don't have to do a lot.
And it shows really your ingenuity or your resourcefulness, the fact that you were able to create these delicious concoctions using a tent stove.
Yeah. It's funny. I the thing that my husband remembers the most about that 4-month camping trip was not just the food, but I used to go to the market and buy like a piece of fabric and make a tablecloth out of it. You know, I liked it to be a whole thing, which is really, I think, what my interest in entertaining is.
So when you get back to the United States, what did you do? Where did you live?
Well, we moved to Washington. Jeffrey was at graduate school at Johns Hopkins. And I got a job, I think, at NASDAQ. I don't know what I was doing there, but it was supposed to be a serious job. And and because I really hated my job, I used to entertain all the time. And I went out and bought Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I worked my way through both of those volumes. And I really taught myself how to cook. And I used to entertain every single weekend. I'd have a dinner party. And I think the dinner party was the anticlimax of the experience. I just loved coming home at night and cooking.
You talk about the dinner party being the anticlimax. Did you feel stressed during those parties?
Oh, it was just really easy. No, it's hard. Of course I did. I'd lie on the sofa on Sunday and go, I'm never doing that again. And then on Monday I'd start cooking again.
Oh.
It's one of the things that is the basis of what I do. Entertaining is really hard. And it's not just getting a dinner out with all the courses at the same time, but it's also creating an atmosphere where people are relaxed and having fun, and they feel like what you've just done, this dinner, is something you just whipped up in the 10 minutes before they got there. Because that's when the host and hostess are having fun, that's the most fun. So I really sort of cut my teeth on those dinner parties in Washington.
Now, while you were in Washington, you also worked for the White House. What did you end up doing there?
After NASDAQ, I actually got a job in the White House, a group called Office of Management and Budget. And as I said, I was interested in science. So I worked in the science area. I worked in nuclear energy policy. I mean, again, what was I doing there?
What were you doing there?
I think I was just trying to prove that I was smart. But at some point, I decided I don't want to grow up to be Jeffrey, as wonderful as he is. I needed to do something else.
Now, you mentioned that you might have wanted to prove that you were smart. Were you trying to maybe prove to yourself or to Jeffrey that you weren't just another kind of housewife with vocational interest?
Gelsie, he wrote a book called Passages, and one of which actually came out when I was just 30 and I was trying to decide what to do. And one of the things that she said is very often women in their 20s try to grow up to be their husbands or their fathers or try to sort of prove themselves. And then exactly at 30, they say, that's not who I am. And they go off and do something that's them. And I think I read this book like a month after I bought Barefoot Contessa. And I thought, that's exactly what I did.
And that's exactly what I did, by the way.
Did
Very
you?
Very resonant.
Isn't that wonderful? So you need to do that. You need to know what it is and know what it's not. And then to have the confidence to go off and do something on your own. Good for you. Great.
Good for you. But before you went off to buy and to operate Barefoot Contessa, you did still spend some time in the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. Mm-hmm. How long were you there?
I was there for 4 years, from 1974 to 1978. I mean, in the beginning, you just say, this is very cool. The issue papers I'm writing are going to the president. I mean, that's pretty sexy. And it was really interesting. But after 4 years, I realized I was working on issues that were $20 billion, which at that time was, I mean, still money, but it was huge. And then 4 years later, I realized I'm still working on the same $20 billion project. I can't get it done, and neither can the president. It's too difficult to get anything done in Washington, and that was in the 70s. Can you imagine now? So I decided I'd rather work on $20 projects, but they were my own $20.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten. Ina has built a culinary empire, starting with her specialty food store in the Hamptons on Long Island, and continuing with her cookbooks and her show on the Food Network. Ina also has a line of prepared ingredients called Barefoot Contessa Pantry in partnership with Stonewall Kitchen, which is based in Maine. Her first 5 books sold over 5 million copies, and her show on the Food Network has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Okay, so you're done with the White House, and you say, I want to move on and get involved in the culinary world and start my own business. What was that process like?
Well, everybody says it was very brave, but it really wasn't. I got to the point in my job where I thought, I can't do this one more minute. And I have a very low threshold of boredom with it, which I think helps push me out the door when it's time to move. And I was in my office at the White House, and I was in OMB, and I was reading the New York Times at like 10 o'clock in the morning. I was exhausted, and I thought, if I'm tired at 10 in the morning, it's not a good sign. And I saw an ad for business for sale that in the, you know, the business opportunity section in the New York Times that you never read. It was the first time I'd ever read it. And there was a specialty food store in a place I'd never been before. It was the Hamptons. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. I was interested in food. I was interested in business. And I wanted to do something on my own. So I went home that night and I said to Jeffrey, I really need to do something different. I really need to just get out of this White House thing and do something on my own. And he said something that was so important. He said, why don't you just pick something you've always wanted to do? Just do it. Don't worry about making money. Just do it. Mm-hmm. And I said, funny you should mention it. I saw this ad for a business for sale. And he said, let's go look at it tomorrow. Isn't that wonderful?
What a husband.
Oh, he's just wonderful. So we jumped in the car the next day. We drove up to a town I'd never been to before, West Hampton. It was March. Anybody that's been to West Hampton in March knows there's like tumbleweed going down the middle of the street. Mm-hmm. And there was this tiny store that just glowed. And I thought, this is exactly what I want to do. So I made the owner a low offer. I thought, well, she'll come back. We'll negotiate. And Jeffrey and I drove back to Washington.
By the way, Washington and West Hampton are, what, 6 hours from each other?
Yeah, at least. Six, maybe eight, yeah.
Why didn't you think of maybe doing this closer to home?
Well, this was the one for sale. I just thought I'd take a chance.
How did you finance the purchase of this new store?
Well, one of the things I used to do when I was in Washington is I used to buy old houses, renovate them, and sell them. It was just to entertain myself, really. But fortunately, I made a little bit of money, so I used that money to buy the store.
What a pioneer. You real estate mogul.
Oh, no. Very tiny.
And you were 30 at the time?
I was exactly 30. It was a month after my 30th birthday. So Gail Sheehy was right.
And Barefoot Contessa, where does the name come from?
Well, it was actually the name of a movie originally from the 50s with Humphrey Bogart and Ava Gardner. And the woman I bought it from, Diana Strada, who's just deeply wonderful, when she was a little girl, she's Italian. So when she was the little girl, they used to call her the Barefoot Contessa. So she actually stayed on with me. One of the things I did was I made a deal with her that she would stay on with me for a month to teach me what I needed to know, because I didn't know how to slice smoked salmon. I didn't know where you buy brie. I didn't know how to tell whether it was ripe. What I knew was like Bonbel from the grocery store. You know, it was the 70s. People didn't make their own bread and they didn't have really good imported cheese. And she was a fabulous teacher.
At the time, was there any self-doubt that this wouldn't work out, or were you kind of confident that this would be
crazy?
Successful?
After the first weekend, I said to Jeffrey, this was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my entire life. Mm. I think as I look back over several stages, what I've done is what I now can recognize is I jump off a cliff and I figure out how to fly on the way down. And it really focuses my attention. I try something I don't think there's any way in hell I can do. And it really forces me to work really hard. But it was something I loved doing. So when I went home at night after an exhausting day at the store, I'd think, well, what do I feel like doing? And what I felt like doing is testing that chocolate cake I had on my mind. So I'd be back at the store. Didn't feel like work. It felt like playing.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, the founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. We'll hear more from Ina coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. Ina is a chef, a cookbook writer, and one of the cooking stars on the Food Network. Ina officially started her culinary career when she bought a 400-square-foot store in the Hamptons on Long Island called the Barefoot Contessa. Her first cookbook sold over 2 million copies, and her Food Network show has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Ina is popular for her emphasis on no-fuss entertaining. Were you always impulsive in your life growing up? Because this was a very impulsive decision to some degree. You were committed to your craft, but it was also 5 hours away from, or more so, from D.C., and you had never done it before.
I think I wasn't impulsive, but I was never allowed to be. Mm. And I think Jeffrey encourages me. He really takes the handcuffs off. And he says to me, looks straight at me and says, you can do this. And it's very empowering for somebody to do that with you.
What impact did your moving to the Hamptons have on your marriage? Did Jeff move with you, or was he in D.C. during the week?
He was in D.C. during the week. He was still working for the Secretary of State. We just decided that he would come up on the weekends. The store was only open in the summer. So for 6 months a year, I worked really hard. And then by the next winter, he'd move to New York and become an investment banker. Mm-hmm. So we basically spent the winters together and then the summer, the weekends. It's not easy. But I mean, we decided we were going to make it work. And if it didn't work, then we would change it.
Now, at 30, many women are about to start a family. And instead, you bought this store. Did you ever think about having children, or what was your psychology with that at the time?
It actually actually was a decision of mine very early, and I didn't want to have children. So it made the decision so much easier. I don't have to choose between work and children. I think there's no way I could have done what I've done if I had children. So that was part of the decision.
Well, that's very realistic, but knowing what I know of you, you probably could have fit it in.
I don't know. That's very nice, but I'm not so sure.
So talk to me about the early days when you were just starting to operate Barefoot Contessa. Did they come immediately, the customers, or what was that dynamic like?
Well, one of the things that was wonderful, in retrospect, I'd like to say I did this deliberately, but in retrospect, is that it was a train that had already left the station. I really don't believe I could have started this from scratch. I didn't know enough. I didn't understand where to buy food. I didn't know how to sell it. I really didn't know anything about it. I just knew how to make brownies for my friends. But making 200 brownies for a store is a whole different science. I started with something that was real, and I decided I would just do that for one summer, exactly the way it was done without changing anything, just to learn how to do it. And yes, there was a line out the door from the first day. I'll tell you a story about the first day was Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. I remember at the end of the day, Jeffrey took off from his job with the Secretary of State to help me get set up. I don't know why, but it was very sweet of him. And at the end of the first day, there was like $85 in the register. And I remember him with a calculator going, "You're never going to make it here." We had no idea that Friday of Memorial Day weekend in the Hamptons was going to be a whole different thing. At the end of the day, Friday, we closed the door at 10 o'clock at night, and there was nothing left in the store, absolutely nothing. And so Diane Estrada and I stayed up all night baking and cooking. We went to the grocery store for flour and sugar. And by the next day, we opened the doors, and there we were.
Now, you seem like a very outgoing individual. In fact, a good friend of yours, I think it was Stephen Drucker, said that Ina glows in the dark. And it seems, though, that cooking can be a very solitary act. You know, you're face-to-face with the ingredients all day. Was that ever an issue for you?
I'm actually not a chef. I think of myself as a cook who's had a little more experience than most people. And I always had a chef who worked in the kitchen. So I mean, Jeffrey used to describe it as a sandbox. There was always something interesting to do in the store. I loved doing the displays. I loved working with customers. I loved working with people who worked with me. And when I had time, I would go in the kitchen and figure out a better chocolate cake. But I was never really stuck doing one thing. And for the way I am, which is slightly ADD, I think, there was always something fun to do in that store.
You say that you're not a chef with some adamancy. Then what are you if not a chef?
I mean, maybe this is a little strong, but I actually think of myself as a business person who cooks. I think that one of the things that served me very well is that I don't know how to make sponge sugar. I don't know how to do what chefs on a line know how to do, which is touch the steak and say it's medium rare. And that's actually why I think my cooking relates to people at home, because I'm still the person standing at the oven door going, "I don't know, is the chicken done?" I mean, it's hard. It's really hard cooking. And if you've done it on a line, it gets easier and easier, and it's never gotten easier for me.
Now, I want to go back to still the Barefoot Contessa days when you did run the store for about 20 years.
Yes.
What was harder for you than you thought? It seemed like you had quite good luck in those early years. You had the customers. You were in a good financial situation. What was more challenging than you expected?
It's really hard work. I loved it because it was really fun, but the hours are hard. I think probably the hardest thing that I didn't count on, you know, when you choose a profession, a lifestyle comes along with it. And very, very often you don't think about the lifestyle. I think the hardest thing was working on weekends. When Jeffrey would come out for the weekend, I was working Saturdays, and then I would go out and cater 10 parties on Saturday night and come home and want to lie on the sofa on Sunday. So I think that was the hardest thing that I didn't count on.
After 20 years, you decided to close shop or to sell the store. What was motivating that decision?
I really felt like I'd done what I needed to do in the specialty food business, and I wasn't bringing the kind of energy to it and the creativity that I thought I should. I sort of hit a wall, and I thought, okay, I can either sell it to somebody else or I can sell it to the two people who actually work in the store, the manager and the chef, and they were interested in buying it. So we worked out a deal, and I sold it to them over time.
How long was that process of deciding that you were going to sell the store?
About 60 seconds. Once I decided to do it, it was time to move on. One of the things that happened to me is a friend of mine who's a therapist said to me, type A people think that they can figure out what to do next while they're doing something. It doesn't work. And finally, in sheer frustration about what I was going to do next, I decided, okay, I'm going to trust her. I'm just going to sell the store. I'm going to build myself an office upstairs, and I'm going to go there at 9 o'clock every morning and say, okay, what am I going to do today? And it was a really hard 8-10 months where I had nothing. I went from being incredibly busy to have nothing to do.
How depressing.
It was really depressing. But I just persevered. I studied the stock market thinking maybe that's what I was going to do. A friend of mine laughs about I was going to start a bus company. I mean, I had all kinds of wacky ideas. And finally, Jeffrey said to me, He's definitely a theme in this. He's my best advisor. He said, you love the food business, stay in the game. And so I thought, well, people have asked me to write cookbooks, so I'm not really interested in writing a cookbook, but it'll be something to do tomorrow.
Mm.
So I made a proposal and sent it to a publisher, and oh my God, they accepted it.
So it was almost a form of therapy to write a cookbook in a way.
It was as simple as I needed something to do. And I thought, well, I'll write a cookbook while I'm figuring out what to do.
I want to go back to some of the things that you were flirting with before you decided, okay, I'm going to write the cookbook. And you mentioned that you were studying the stock market. What did you read?
Everything Warren Buffett had ever written or been said about Warren Buffett. He's just amazing. And I admire his talent, but you have to be as smart as Warren Buffett to do that.
Do you do your own investing?
I did then. Not really.
Okay, so you decide to write this cookbook, even if you weren't going to finish it.
I had this contract with Clarkson Potter to write a cookbook, and I said to my new editor, Roy Finnemore, I said, well, first thing we need to do is hire somebody to write the book, because I don't know how to write. I know how to write nuclear energy issue papers, but that's it. And he said, no, you're going to write the book. So I took all the money they gave me, put it in a separate account, because I thought, I'll be sending this back to them sometime, because there's no way I'm going to do this. And just out of sheer desperation of something to do, I started writing down the recipes that we'd used in the store. And then came the first photo shoot. And I hired the best of everybody that I could find, and we all got together in my house, and we started doing photographs. And that was so exciting. I loved doing that. And all of a sudden, the whole process became really fun. I never would have known.
And how much of your own money did you invest in the process?
Well, actually, the truth is I invested about $200,000 in the first cookbook, which is insane for a cookbook when you think of all the books out there. But I decided I really wanted to do this. If I was going to do it, I was going to make a business out of it, and I want to knock the ball out of the park.
And do you remember that first moment when you saw the cookbook in its completion?
I'll never forget it. I was driving to New York, and my editor called and said, where are you? I said, well, I'm just coming into New York. He said, stop by my office. And I said, I don't have time to stop by your office. I had a meeting. He said, well, just drive right up to the front of the office and I'll come out and give you something. I thought, oh, what is this? Mm-hmm. And there I was standing on the street when he handed me the first book. And I don't think anybody who writes cookbooks will ever forget their first cookbook.
How were sales initially?
Well, I was quite surprised, I have to say. The first time I was asked to give a talk, right after the book came out, it was before Mother's Day, and I was going out to California to somewhere in Orange County. Actually, Martha Stewart used to say, stop at bookstores and ask if you can sign them, and I thought, oh, just too shy to do that. I could never. But Jeffrey said, come on, let's stop at a bookstore, and we stopped at a Barnes & Noble in Newport, California, and I very shyly went up to the manager and said, would you like me to sign my books for you? And he said, well, what's the book? And I thought, oh, he'll never have heard of this. And I said, the Barefoot Contessa cookbook. And he said, oh, we have 50 of them on a table in the middle of the store. And I thought, oh my God, you do? And we walked over there and there wasn't a book on the table. And he said, oh, I was out yesterday. We must have sold them all yesterday. And I thought, oh, my God. It was the first inkling I had that there was something happening. And it was really quite thrilling. I wrote the book I wanted to read. And that's what I shot for. I wanted you to open the book and say, oh, my God, that photograph makes the food look so delicious. And then look at the recipe and say, that's really easy. I could do that. And there was something, I think, in that that appealed to people.
And I appreciate the little tips on in the margins.
Oh, thank you.
For example, you said that squeezing a cold lemon produces less lemon juice than squeezing kind of a warm or room temperature
lemon. It does.
And I guess if you think of science, that makes sense because I guess the molecules are faster when it's warmer, or what's the reason behind
it? I can't even tell you what the science is. I know it works, but you learn that in a specialty food store when somebody says to you, could you squeeze a case of lemons for me?
Mm.
And you never want to do them cold.
Now, you had an interest in science growing up. Do you see cooking as a science at all?
I totally see it as science. When I decide I want to make a new recipe for scones, I see it as a science experiment. I start with something. First, I do all the research that I can about what everybody says about scones. And then I put all the books away and I say, okay, what do I want this to taste like? I get a flavor and a texture in my head, and then I just start baking.
Mm.
And it might take me a day. It might take me a week. I might make 3 versions, I might make 25 versions, and I certainly have done that until I hit that ping in my head that says this is exactly what I'm looking for. And it's really, really, it's really like a science experiment to me, except instead of ending up with hydrochloric acid, I end up with scones.
Something edible.
Exactly.
Any other little tips just for me?
Oh. Well, one of the trademarks of the recipes is that I want you to feel confident when you go to the store. So, for example, in the Virginia ham glaze, it calls for 6.5 ounces of chutney. And when you go to the store, the jar is 6.5 ounces. So you say to yourself, oh, I've got the right jar. So everything I do is to make you feel confident.
And how about shocking the vegetables? I noticed I was doing a recipe, I think it was with sweet peas, and you said boil them for 3 minutes and then shock them in ice cold water. How come?
If you boil something until it's done and then you throw it in ice water, it stops the cooking and it sets the color.
Mm.
And then you can use it anytime you need it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire Barefoot Contessa. Ina is the star of the Food Network show Barefoot Contessa, named after the store that she ran for 20 years in the Hamptons on Long Island. Ina's first cookbook, Barefoot Contessa, sold over 2 million copies. Another tip I appreciated was how you explained that kosher salt is sweeter than iodized salt?
It is. And it's very interesting. One of the things I do is I'll go to the store and get everything in a category, like all the salts. Mm. And the only way you can really tell what you like without any memory issues is to just line them all up and taste them all. So I took iodized salt, kosher salt, sea salt, flaked salt, fleur de sel, gray fleur de sel. I line them up on the counter and I just taste them all. And then you know forever which one you like. And when you do that, it's very clear that kosher salt is not as harsh as iodized salt, traditional table salt, what we call table salt.
Now, when you're in the kitchen with your experimenting, are you listening to music?
Yeah, I do.
What kind of music?
It gets me going, the energy. You know what I love is all of the Cost CDs. They're all mixed by a hotel in Paris called Cost, C-O-S-T-E-S.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
This is all done in your kitchen in East Hampton?
It is. As Jeffrey says, I commute to work in my slippers. It's not a bad life.
That's the best. And speaking of your kitchen in East Hampton, the Food Network show has been filmed in your kitchen in East Hampton.
It is indeed.
How did you end up on the Food Network?
Well, they very kindly came to me and asked if I would do a cooking show. And as with all of my other endeavors, I said, absolutely not. I couldn't imagine I could do this. So for actually a couple of years, they kept coming back every 6 months and saying, would you do it? And making me a better offer. And I kept saying no. I think they thought I was negotiating, but I really didn't think I could do it. One of the things I wanted is I wanted it to be a story. I didn't want it to be just cooking. I wanted it to be the story of something. And the producer, Rachel Parnell at Pacific, was so smart because she said, well, it could be the story of a party.
Mm.
And so that's what we did. And we wanted it to be very real. I didn't want it to be sort of made up and prettified. So Rachel and I, before each show, sit down, and my other producer, Olivia Grove, we sit down and we say, okay, what did I do yesterday? What did I do last week? Did I have a party that was really fun? Did Jeffrey bring me something that was special? So that it's very real. And my favorite question that people email me all the time and say, is that your television husband or your real husband? And I write them back, I'm not that good an actress. He's the real thing.
And he is on the show often.
He's wonderful. He's just great on the show.
It's striking to me how you've really launched a second career, even though it related to what you were doing for 20 years, at age 50 or at age 51. That's refreshing for people who think that they can have one career and then that's it.
It's actually one of my favorite things because it astonishes me that I did that. When I sold Barefoot Contessa, I thought, it's time to do something new, but I'll never find something as engaging and as compelling as running a specialty food store. And what's amazing to me is that at 50, I started a completely new career. I mean, it's in the food business, but it's completely different. It's so much more interesting, so much more engaging, and I just adore it.
How many episodes do you do a year, roughly?
Well, I do 20 episodes a year. You know, I try and incorporate East Hampton and the beach, and we go to the Honey Place. We go to the, you know, all, really to focus on the local produce and chickens from Iacona Farm. But we just do 20 shows a year.
And how long does it take to produce one show?
It takes 2 days, and we're talking long days, from 8 in the morning till 7 at night, to produce a 22-minute show.
Wow. Have you seen yourself improve from the earliest show to now?
You're assuming I see the shows. I can't stand to see the shows. I'm thrilled that people like them, but I think, why would they want to watch her? I'm much more comfortable. Confident, I wouldn't be so sure, but I'm certainly more comfortable.
I like one episode where at the end you made, I think it was green goddess dressing, which is sour cream and mayonnaise and fresh basil, and you dress the salad, you go upstairs, you sit in front of your computer, and you have dinner answering emails. And I loved it because it was so realistic. It's a lot of us sometimes, you know, eat by ourselves and we're working in front of the computer.
Thank you. It really reflects my life. I mean, there are days when I go out with friends, and there are days when my husband's there, and there are days when I answer emails all night.
Was there any part of you that was loath to kind of make your life open to 6 million viewers? Did you and Jeffrey have to sit down and say, okay, do we want this type of show where they're going to be seeing everything, or...
I think that that I wanted it so much to be a reality that I was really willing to, you know, to show the whole thing. Well, maybe not the whole thing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jessica. It was really fun.
My guest has been Ina Garten, founder of the Barefoot Contessa. Coming up, we'll meet Sam Farber, founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. Sam also founded another cookware company in 1960 called Kakko, with products of enameled cast iron and enameled steel. Sam's career has been about designing universal, human-centric products for all ages and capacities. So a carrot peeler that works for a 30-year-old should also work comfortably for a 70-year-old with arthritis. OXO sells over 500 products and has extended beyond the kitchen to the garden and the barbecue. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You started OXO at what stage of your life?
I was 65 years old. I had retired in 1988 from Kakko, and one of my dreams had always been to go and live in France for a while. So Betsy, my wife, and I rented a house in Provence and spent 2 months of the year for 3 years there.
So what was the catalyst then for leaving retirement and starting OXO?
We do cook a lot, and one of the days Betsy turned to me and said, why can't somebody make a kitchen tool that's comfortable? Betsy has some arthritis in her hands. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. And so the first thing we did, actually, was to go and buy some clay, some modeling clay, and put it around the handles of the various tools we could find in the stores in France. Made them larger. We had a whole refrigerator full of handles with modeling clay on them. And finally decided that it was a good idea. And so I got on the phone and called David Stoll, who's head of smart design, and with whom I'd worked before, and said, I have this wonderful idea, Dave, and I think it's a good idea. Let me run it by you. And I spoke to him about the idea of making a line of kitchen tools with a soft, comfortable handle. It wasn't just the comfortable handle. We wanted a good product that was easy to use, that was dishwasher safe, and fairly well priced, we hope. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, there were peelers selling for 99 cents. We came out at $5.99, I believe, and people looked at it and said, oh, no one will ever pay that price for a peeler. Well, they paid it.
Were you itching at all to start a business, or were you kind of content in your retirement?
I think I was itching to start a business. A very good question. I enjoyed myself, but I think somewhere deep inside was this knowledge that I wasn't going to retire and ski and play tennis or do something else.
So what did you do to come up with that first peeler?
Well, the first thing we did was to observe people using kitchen tools. And because we were interested in doing it for a wide body of consumers, we didn't want to make a prosthetic device for a few people. We wanted to make something that everybody could use. It was called universal design at that point. They studied people in New York with the New York Arthritis Society. And then the other end of the spectrum, they studied chefs working with it.
Did you have a problem with marketing because people thought that it was just a geriatric product?
No, I think the problem we had in marketing may have been more they're getting used to a very fat handle. It was different from all other handles, and also probably some price sensitivity.
Now, you have a material on your products that looks like rubber, but it's actually called santoprene. What is santoprene?
It's a combination of polypropylene and rubber, actually. I know it was used in the automotive field. We were the first ones to use it in our field, actually. So many people copied us afterwards and used it in the field for everything.
Now, how did you go about manufacturing the product?
I knew someone who had a factory in New Jersey making the bicycle handles, which had the same idea in many ways because they had the thin fins at the top of the handle that we had. And the engineers looked at it and said, we can't do it. It can't be made. Those fins are too thin. We'll never get a decent product out of it. Being an entrepreneur and having an idea and then you never stop because you want to see that idea come to fruition, I got in touch with people I'd worked with in Japan, and the owner of the factory in Japan looked at it and said, very interesting, surely we can do it. And they did it easily.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company of transgenerational products that are easy to use. OXO has won many awards, including from the Arthritis Foundation, and OXO's Good Grips have been selected for permanent collections at the Museum of Modern Art, among others. Now, before you started OXO, you actually had a career in cooking and kitchenware.
I decided I wanted to go into something in the home area. I had been working in a family business for 9 years. We got along well, but that it wasn't where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. I wanted to be on my own. I was on a train to a Harvard-Yale game and was talking about going into business, and the wife of my college roommate said, why doesn't someone make a beautifully designed line of cast iron cookware? There isn't such a thing. It's all traditional, and no one does it in modern design. Marvin Traub, who was at Bloomingdale's at the time and later became chairman of Bloomingdale's, said, that's a wonderful idea. Why don't you go and see the buyer in our gourmet department? Mm. Which I did. He was excited about it, and I decided to make it. So I investigated and got in touch with people I knew in Europe and went to Europe and visited a number of factories. A designer in Denmark, Acton Bjorn, told me about a factory in northern Denmark, and I made an appointment, went to see them, and I got there, and it was a marvelous old factory. They said they could do it. After a year, we finally managed to get a product.
How adventurous. This was in 1960. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Yonkers, New York.
What was the state of design, at least in the houseware field, in 1960, when you were first starting out? What was design?
It was a desert. People were just set in their ways, well, what they did, and they thought that by changing a color, they changed the design, actually.
Do you think it had anything to do with a lot of people coming out of the Depression era and after World War II, or?
Well, I think that that might have some bearing upon it, because when World War II ended, there was a hungry market there. And so you didn't have to worry about making great advances in design and innovation, let's say, in general. So there may have been a number of years where people sat back and just said, well, we can sell everything we make. Look at the car industry. That's a perfect example of it, you know. They were there so far, they just went on doing the same thing they'd done. And finally, they lost out, as they're losing out now, to people who thought about design. I drive a Prius, Toyota Prius, and it's wonderful.
Speaking of things related to World War II, you were in World War II.
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm.
Where did you serve?
Majority of time in North Africa, and Libya, and southern Turkey. I was not in combat. Everyone who was there was willing to go home, actually. But I did have it easy, I must say. I can't complain about the time. It was just a lot out of your life, really. You know, for instance, when I came back to college, I had a lot of credits. If I'd had it do over again, I wouldn't have taken those credits. Mm-hmm. I would have stayed in college and gone through a normal college education. Mm-hmm. This way, I was just sort of floating around trying to get out of college mm-hmm. at the time.
Where did you go to college?
Harvard.
And what did you think you were doing when you got out of college?
Well, first of all, I thought when I went into college that I would be a lawyer. And I did go to Harvard Law School for two semesters. Sitting one day in a contracts class, I said to myself, why am I here? I'm bored. And went on training program at Abraham & Strauss, a department store in Brooklyn at that time. I decided I would go with the family business. It was more lucrative at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. Now, we keep talking about human-centered designs and universal designs. What does that mean?
Well, it basically is considering the broadest spectrum of the populace when you make the design.
What are some examples of consumers who have benefited from these universal designs?
We used to get a lot of letters from people thanking us for making OXO peelers and OXO products. One of the ones that we remember very well is the woman who said that she gave a peeler to her grandmother, and the grandmother was able, it was a spoon actually, not a peeler, one of our mixing spoons, and that the grandmother was able to make brownies for the first time in many years for her grandchildren.
Did you have any issues with competition once you presented these products to the market? Would people try to copy OXO?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Within 6 months, there were other products in the market that were copying of OXO, loads of them. When it was possible, we did sue. We won some cases, so people folded before the cases, actually.
It seems like lawsuits or the notion of litigation gives me such a headache, and it's such an expensive process. Mm. Did you ever feel like, oh, I don't necessarily want to spend the money, and maybe we should just go head-to-head with them? Or were you adamant about going to court with them?
We were somewhat adamant, but again, we were a tiny company with limited resources, and that's, of course, the larger companies take advantage of that because they know you won't sue because you can't afford all the money to go to court, really. So you sue where you really, really, really know you're going to win. For instance, we had a company in Canada who actually copied the peeler exactly, but they made the mistake of photographing our peeler for their package.
Whoa.
Okay. Yeah. And it showed there was a slight difference of some kind, and they just folded right away. I mean, they knew that, and we sent us $150,000 immediately. And that's a case where you would sue. But there are the cases where the borderline cases, you were hesitant to sue, really. So the really best way was to do what I've said many times, is to compete basically by doing innovative product and doing it quickly, ahead of the market all the time. And that's what OXO does today.
Now, when you say about doing it quickly, you mean being the first mover, getting out there before other people. Some people say that being the first mover is actually a disadvantage because you don't have time to work out the kinks. And the second guy to come along, as you say, gets the cheese.
The second mouse gets the cheese.
There we go.
I don't believe in it, really. Basically, what happens is that the market gets to know that you're the people to look to for a new product. Look what's come out of OXO over the past few years. There's a marvelous salad spinner, a great story behind it, if I may tell it.
Please.
We mentored projects in graduate business schools at Harvard and Babson primarily, where you put together designers, business school people, and if you can, engineers. The salad spinner came out of a project at Babson. One of the business school people was playing with a Fisher-Price toy, I believe. You press up and down a top or something like that, and got excited about it and said, we can actually make the salad spinner this way. And that's where it came from, that the innovative product, way ahead of the market all the time. And so you build a brand that way. OXO did no advertising. It was primarily about people buying one OXO product and realizing that all OXO products were very unusual and satisfied their needs.
I read an interesting story about when OXO entered Japan, the products seemed so big to the consumer. In fact, the salad spinner was called a restaurant-sized salad spinner because, you know, they use products that are much smaller. They hold a spatula like a pen, whereas Americans hold a spatula like a tennis racket.
Yes, that's true.
So OXO had to kind of re-innovate to fit that market.
That would have been after my time, certainly. But it brings up another interesting part of the design world, which is the cultural aspect. In thinking about design, you take into consideration the physical, the cognitive. We're working on the emotional right now. You want design to give you a feeling of joy and accomplishment, not fear, anger, and frustration, actually. And so we're just sort of thinking a lot about that right now. And the cultural fits in with that as well.
What is your interaction with design on a daily basis?
I think about design. I was going to write a book with Patricia Moore, who's a designer and gerontologist. We haven't gotten around to it yet. It was called Ouch, Bad Design Hurts. And when you went through the entire day and pointing out bad design, I'll give you for instance of that. You wake up in the morning, your alarm clock rings, you can't find the button to turn it off. Now, why can't someone's going to make it after I say this, of course, why can't there be one big red light that pops up in the dark so you can turn it off? And as you go through the whole day and you're a design thinker, and that's what I do, and go in the bathroom and see everything wrong in that bathroom. It's fascinating.
What is wrong in that bathroom? What's an example?
Oh, well, they still have, you know, round knobs on doors, so when you come out with the slippery hands, you can't turn the knob around, for instance. That's a typical thing in the bathroom. As you go in the kitchen, we bought a toaster oven a few years ago, and it had a round white dial on it. And the marking where it was the arrow was a little faint indentation in it, and I couldn't see it. And so Betsy went in the bathroom, got her red nail polish, and made that into a red dot so I could see it at that point. And you can't imagine why a designer would design something like that. They're not thinking about the user at that point. And to me, it's very fascinating.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. You really incorporated your family into the business, into OXO. What role did your wife and your son play in the business?
Well, Betsy looked over my shoulder in the room that we were using for a year as we were getting going. So she became part of it. She is an architect, along with being many other things, poet. So she did the PR, worked on the packaging and the printed material in general. And when I started the company, my son John, who was in Wall Street at that time, was very fascinated by it and was an investor in it. When we showed in San Francisco, he came to see what was going on and got so excited about it that he decided to leave Wall Street and join us.
Some people might be reluctant to bring family members into the business just because of all the complicated relationships that might result. What were your feelings about that?
I'd worked for my father, who was a very wonderful guy, loved him dearly, but I disagreed with him most of the time. And I thought that it was not great to have family in the business and didn't invite my sons into the business at any time. We got along. It was okay. I don't really feel that you can isolate the emotional aspects, family emotional aspects, from your daily life in business. And that's a problem that you face. John and I are still together. We still do consulting. If I did it over again, well, if they wanted to come, I would say, I welcome them in. But I don't think it's great. Other people I can manage it very well, really. Mm-hmm. It may be my personality that doesn't manage it, really. So Betsy and I manage it with a little family therapy, and it worked out quite well, actually.
You mentioned before we were talking about universal design and it appealing to a broader spectrum of the populace. Mm-hmm. You also are very interested in outsider art, mm-hmm. which in a way also incorporates the broader spectrum of the populace. What is outsider art?
We're still working on that. It's the same question as what is design, but basically, it's art done by untrained artists, self-taught artists, who may be institutionalized, may isolates, eccentrics, being obsessives, although, you know, mainstream artists have some of this themselves. I mean, they're obsessed with obsession and passionate, get very close together, you know. But there is a certain otherness about it, let's say, is the word we use, really. I became very passionate about outsider art when I first saw it. I saw it in England in a house, a woman who was an agent for a mainstream artist that I was interested in, and I said, what is that? I'm fascinated by it. It moved me tremendously, and I started to find out about outsider art.
And in your retirement, you spent a lot of time on your interest in outside art. You had a Soho studio.
And being an entrepreneur, I opened a gallery with Rosa Esmond, who had a mainstream gallery in Soho. We ran it for about 2 years. And it was marvelous. It was great fun. We were one of the early people in it, not the earliest, but one of the early people in the field, did wonderful exhibits. And then I realized that you can't keep losing money all the time, so I stopped.
So then you decided to make money by starting OXO.
Shortly after. You're right. That's about 5 years later, actually, was what it amounted to.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
My guest has been Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.